Welcome today to our interview series with outstanding professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Finesh Murthy, CEO, iGate. Finesh is a global founding ICT industry top executive. Finesh, you just have an amazing background, and it's such a pleasure to have you come in to do this interview. So thank you for sharing your deep experiences with our audience.
My pleasure completely, Stephen. It's a pleasure to be here, and happy to share some of my thoughts here.
Well, Finesh, in looking over your history, you've got some amazing accomplishments. And so if you can share or profile some of your work history and maybe provide a defining or usable lesson that you want to share from all of these major events and roles in your life.
Sure. Let me go backwards, if you will. And I think the most major thing we did was one of the industry's largest buyouts in the services space. We recently took over a company which was about 2.5 times our size in a leveraged buyout. I think the biggest learning I got, because the industry calls it as one of the most successful integrations, is you just have to keep a very open mind throughout the integration process. No egos, just keep a very open mind throughout the integration process, because lots of things keep moving, there are lots of moving parts, things change, and keeping that open mind throughout and evaluating the best alternative regardless of where it came from has worked very well from us. And from the perspective of the from the financial perspective, of course, we had estimated that we will save so much on shared services. We had estimated that we will be able to protect our customers so well, etc. All of those objectives have been met. So I just think that lesson is a great lesson for somebody who has tried to merge and integrate companies. The other interesting thing, if I go back about 10 years, was another important lesson where when I started a company with some partners, we raised $30 million in first round of capital. And at that point of time, there were multiple views. The first view was raise a little bit of capital and don't dilute yourself too much. And in fact, actually, that was the most prevalent view that, it's just no need to raise so much capital when you don't intend to use it all at once. And to me, the percentage of ownership multiplied by the value that you can create is the value that you will end up getting, and not just the percentage of ownership. And if we can create value faster using a little more capital, even though it dilutes your equity ownership down, I think it's worthwhile. Plus, if you want to give the organization the best chance of success, and particularly because we were going to be dealing with large financial institutions, having some cash on the balance sheet always makes them feel a little better. And therefore, for the questions, which many entrepreneurs go through, is how much capital should I raise? How much should I dilute myself? Should I just raise little at a time? I think capital raising is a very distracting process, in the sense that it consumes a lot of time, it consumes a lot of effort and energy. And if you're the entrepreneur, it actually will consume more of your time and energy, which could be spent in trying to build value in the company. And raising larger chunks of capital at a time, I think, to me, is always a better strategy than small pieces which help you preserve your ownership in terms of percentage of equity a little better. And then going back, another 10 years, if I look back when I first came into the U.S. To start the operations for another IT services companies, I think many people told me that I won't be successful because the U.S. consulting companies and had intimate knowledge of customer systems and processes and so on. And therefore, we wouldn't be successful in creating an offshore industry. And my whole philosophy at that point of time was, I'm just going to change the rules of the game. And by changing the rules of the game, suddenly all these assets which these companies were considering as their big core assets suddenly became millstones and liabilities around their necks. I think the biggest learning has always been that never worry about dreaming big, never worry about dreaming bold, but always follow it up with changing the rules of the game if you're taking on some incumbents. So I just thought I'll leave you with these three thoughts, Stephen.
Well, that's just amazing what you've accomplished. And it sounds like maybe all of the work that you did at IIT, perhaps that had some sort of basis because you're used to being flexible and agile and undergoing rigor.
The fact that, coming from an educational background or coming from an industry where there is so much of change, I think certainly molds your view, your worldview and your opinion on various things. And yes, and also living, I think, in California, being part of the Silicon Valley, having spent a fair amount of time there where everybody always needs just a few million dollars to change the entire world, I think also does change your worldview. So I do believe that all of these experiences are part of what makes any individual what he is or she is today.
You know, it's interesting, in your history you talked about what's required to be an entrepreneur and, you know, gave some tips about raising funding and so on. The next question is related to that. Is there anything more that you can add about some of the best practices and lessons for the founding of companies?
I think there is one fairly important lesson I can certainly add, and that is never found a company with friends only as your partners, in the sense that if you don't know their work ethic, if you don't know what is their appetite to run the long race, if you don't know what are their pressures and stresses in terms of liquidity needs. I think what happens too often is that it's a very comfortable environment to start a company with friends. And when the chips are down, that's when you really find out how people react in a work environment. And not knowing that, I think, will cause you significant grief. So if you're starting a company with friends, my advice would be, really have these difficult conversations up front. But preferably, make friends out of people who have the similar work ethic as you and similar lasting powers and subscribe to the same vision as you, etc., and then try and make friends out of them rather than the other way around.
An add-on to that, I should say, is maybe execution, execution, execution?
Certainly at the end of the day, the moment you do anything, it's an investment of your time, and your time has an opportunity cost built to it. If you raise external capital, you now have an obligation to investors to provide them a reasonable return on the capital. So you're absolutely right, Stephen. I mean, execution is the key, because how you build your model, how you bring your ideas is part of the issue, but how you execute against those ideas, how you can actually create value, and that's only by executing against your plan. I think that's the most important thing.
And I know that that's your founding vision behind iGate, and that is that you want to create value. So on this next question, what are the tremendous opportunities for innovative IT approaches with businesses out there?
I think if you think about the world today, too often we believe that a lot of patterns are set. And to me, innovation has always opened up completely new doors. When we innovated on an operating model, which was basically doing things faster, cheaper, and better, but from a different geography, we became more process-centric, more process-focused, more quality-focused, and so on. And it brought a sea change and a major innovation in the IT industry. Today, we are working on a slightly different model, and that is to create what I consider an outcomes-based model. Too often and for too long, we have been paying purely for effort without getting the results. And my whole philosophy is that we want to make sure that we can get a model going where a customer pays only for results. And that in this industry would be considered significant innovation. So I do believe that there is no limit to what innovation can occur. I saw a very nice and interesting clip. I was once conducting a leadership workshop, and I asked some people for examples of what they considered dead-end jobs. And one of them actually suggested one of the dead-end jobs was a newspaper boy delivering newspapers to an apartment complex. I mean, basically delivering newspapers. He has to go to each house and just drop the newspapers off. And I found a very nice, interesting clip, which showed that even in that kind of a space, how much difference innovation can bring. And it showed that he used to take more than an hour to do the job earlier, and with innovation and with one great idea, he was able to bring the problem down to a few minutes. And therefore, you know, when somebody tells me what are the opportunities for innovation and innovative approaches, I believe that companies all over the world, you know, whether they're US, whether they're Canada, whether they're Europe, it doesn't matter. Companies all over the world are looking for help, looking for innovative ways to do things, because at the end of the day, the mega changes or the mega jumps that you can make in your business performance is only by innovation. Incremental changes you can make in your business performance by process improvement. You know, if I go back a little, you know, if you remember, way back, the architecture of the high jump used to be, you know, where we would jump across a barrier, lift our legs and basically jump over. And, you know, the body is always vertical and so on and so forth. And then, you know, the structure of the jump changed to a Fosbury flop. That was a huge innovation where basically they decided to go head first and over the bar. Now, in the earlier model, you know, you were gaining world records in quarter of an inch, half an inch. And suddenly, in overnight, you started gaining the world record in feet. And this is what I mean when I say that innovation can bring substantial and mega changes to your business in a very dramatic manner.
You know, this whole discussion of innovation and maybe having it outcomes focused kind of resonates with me. I was asked to speak at two sessions in the ISACA World Congress, and one at the board level and the one at the CTO-CIO level. And it was interesting that innovation was just a big byword of the entire event, like how to do it, how to make it work, making it outcomes focused, as you indicated, and sort of you know, delivering real results that are tangible and that can be measured. And I guess you would have a clear picture of that, and we'll get into that as we continue this discussion. So this whole idea of innovation really kind of resonates. Now, you talk about an outcomes-based model, which you said is an innovation within the innovation space itself, just thinking in that way. So what are the advantages of an outcome-based model?
You know, Stephen, when we as individuals behave, take decisions, work, etc., we actually are very outcomes focused. I don't remember the last time you or I went to a barber, for example, and told him, I'll pay you $500 an hour or $100 an hour to cut my hair. We expect a certain quality level, we expect a certain service level, we want to know the price level, and then we want to decide whether we want to do this or not. So to us as individuals, outcomes are important. We would feel, if you look at all products that we buy, let me just move the world away from services for the time being. If you look at all the products that we buy, when we go out and buy an automobile or a refrigerator or anything, we look at a quality level, we look at a service level, and we look at the cost level or price level, and then we decide whether we're going to buy it or not. We don't worry about how many engineers it has taken, how long to design the product, how many mechanics, how many assemblymen, how long, how much material has gone, and we don't worry about all of that. Because we don't want to be concerned with what we are thinking as input parameters. Yet the same individuals, when we end up in organizations, feel very comfortable paying for effort, which is actually just an input, rather than paying for the results, which is the outcome. And that is the behavioral change that we are trying to bring about in organizations, having created the industry's first, what we call outcomes-based model. A model where, you know, a customer will only pay for the business results that he gets, rather than paying for the effort or the input that goes into creation of those business results. The advantages are huge. Of course, the first thing is it pretty much guarantees your business case. So since most IT and other projects are done because of some business benefit, this helps with that. The second thing is that it helps variabilize your cost structure. Since a lot of our work, let's say, potentially could be done on a per loan basis, because that's a business outcome that somebody wants more loans, or per payment process, or some per insurance policy, et cetera, or per order, a customer order received, or whatever it is. So the idea is to bring about a basic metric of commerce between a customer and a vendor, such that there is a potential for partnership, rather than you going at loggerheads against the primary metric of commerce, which is dollars for time. Because in the dollars for time model, what you end up doing is you produce more time, which is not what the customer wants. The vendor wants to produce more time, the customer wants less time. Whereas in this outcomes-based model, it creates a much better alignment and between the customer and the vendor, creating potential for better partnerships. And at the end of the day, it makes both people pull in the same direction of more outcomes. So to me, this model will be the future. And 15 or 20 years later, CFOs will be wondering why they didn't always follow this model. Why did they ever pay for effort? They should have always paid for outcomes. And I believe that services will start getting specified as finely or as closely as products do today, encapsulating all of the intellectual capability into that. So the intellectual capital will go into making that service, a much more fixed kind of a service. And a very trivial example of that, I would say, is, you know, to some extent, somebody pricing for an outcome would be, let's say, for example, when you get things done in payroll or so on, you don't normally pay for a whole lot of other things except per pay slip or whatever it is. And we are trying to attempt to do this in core processes for insurance companies, for banks, for manufacturing companies, and getting them to understand the concept of paying for outcomes. And it's a huge innovation, on the business model side, but also on the delivery model side, because you have to integrate the business process with technology. You have to change your quality systems. You have to change your people compensation systems. You have to change the profile of training, profile of people that you're recruiting, etc. So it's an integrated model, and I think that's really the big change that we are trying to bring about in the industry, Stephen.
That's a great message to get out, and a great new framework for the future. And I'm just thinking of this whole host of world events coming up where I think that message needs to be spread out and everybody endorsing it. Now, on the next question, why are large IT solution providers well positioned to take on more risk and make the initial investments in technology and operations to better serve their customers?
Well, while I believe that large companies are probably better served to take on more risk, generally large companies tend to be poorer at innovation because they are incumbents trying to hold on to the model and hold on to a way of doing things. Now, on the risk side, clearly, if you look at on the investment side, large companies by definition tend to have healthier balance sheets. Large companies by definition have a lot more people working for them, so more intellectual capital at their disposal. And therefore, they can actually do a certain percentage of their deals where they can continue to invest and build solutions for the future. Now, on a smaller company basis, what ends up happening is that the pressures of return, the pressures of immediate cash flows, etc., probably come in the way of doing some of these things. It's just a question of resources. You have more intellectual capability available with you. You have more financial capital available with you, and you can deploy the two together to really invest for something for the future.
Vinish, you are a world-renowned authority, an executive, just an amazing history, as I indicated earlier, and so really well-positioned perhaps for this question, and that is, which emerging technologies or movements do you find exciting, scary, or that promise to alter our lives?
Well, you know, the whole promise of anything, anytime, anywhere, the world of on-demand, I find amazingly exciting. And, you know, whether you call it because of cloud-based models or whether you call it because of storage done somewhere else, I think this is a phenomenal change that the world has seen over the last 15 to 20 years. We went from doing our mails, doing anything that we wanted to do, from one physical device tethered to one physical location, to now being able to do it from, you know, from the wilderness forests in Canada or from the beaches in Hawaii or wherever it is. And I think that, to me, is one of the most exciting things, the fact that you have access to your documents. The fact is that you have access to your data, your music, your pictures. You can have access to anything you want, anytime, anywhere, anyhow, pretty much. And I think that's the most exciting thing that we are seeing emerging today, and a whole host of, therefore, vertical applications. I mean, you know, earlier you could have your email anywhere, now you can have your pictures anywhere, then, you know, you can have your songs anywhere, and so on and so forth. So I think that's something which is very, very exciting, and going down on that path, I think you will continue to see a theme develop where you can do anything anywhere anyhow. One of the things that clearly I find, you know, or a couple of the things which I find very scary, clearly the amount of information that we are giving up about ourselves allows smart analytics to know us better than we know ourselves, and certainly allows smart analytics to know us better than our spouses, our friends, and so on and so forth. And how that information can be used is actually quite scary. How that information can be used to, you know, on a positive side, maybe market products or services to me, but on a negative side, you know, see a side of me which maybe I didn't want people to see, effectively invade my privacy, I think is a little bit of a scary thing. The second scary thing, of course, is that with today's technology, anybody who has got a phone with a camera effectively is a content generator, content distributor, all rolled into one in real time. If you slip and fall on a banana peel, and God forbid, 20 years ago you did that, your pride was hurt and hopefully nothing else, now you may find about 1 million people watching it on the internet because somebody managed to catch it and said, ha ha, right? And therefore, I think the world is becoming a lot less forgiving. The world is watching everything that everybody is doing. And I keep trying to, you know, tell the young guys, be careful of what you put on your Facebook or something, because it could come back to bite you later, and maybe 5-7 years later. And that's really scary, you know, that you were young, you maybe made a mistake, and it stays with you forever. And these are the kinds of things that I find very scary about some of these emerging technologies, you know, these ability to do some of these things with the mobility and with the viewing patterns and so on. What I find, again, very exciting is the fact that we have a great capability to make our lives so much more productive. The whole world of the future where I can get a personal digital assistant, you know, what the old PDAs were, but this is like a real personal valet or a butler to do all my stuff, like a potential Jeeves, if you will. I'll just tell them, you know, please arrange for this, and it all gets done. I mean, these are huge, huge, huge productivity aids which can happen in the future, and I think I do believe that the world is going to get more and more complex. We are going to get better tools to be more productive. At the same time, it's scary as to how much technology overtakes our life and really has, you feel almost completely inept when you don't have all of the technology at your service.
You know, those are some very interesting comments. I guess on the mobility side, it's all about that bring your own device and the, sort of the impact that's even having on all these corporations out there. And you talked about smart analytics, and I guess that ties into like machine learning and big data.
Yes.
And then you have these other aspects like social media and cybersecurity, sustainability, gamification. It's just such a complex world. How do you keep up with it, right? Now, for the next question, what changes do you foresee to the skills needed for this future, and how can we prepare the workforce for this new reality?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I keep talking to various companies and our companies that invariably we are finding that people coming into the workforce have such high degrees of sophistication and technology sophistication that we have to raise our level of writing applications and IT work to such a level that till now we were never tested. I mean, earlier we used to write our applications which would serve a very comfortable 9-to-5 or an 8-to-5 crowd, and now our applications, everything that you write, everything that you do has to be running 24/7. It goes down for 2 minutes. Everybody's screaming. So it's a dramatically different stress level. The second thing is most people have been exposed to various, very sophisticated consumer applications. And by having been exposed to very sophisticated consumer applications, they expect the same level of sophistication in the business applications. And therefore, if you find that suddenly you don't get image-based searches available on your inventory, people start thinking, well, you know, that's what should be there. Why? Because, you know, I can take a picture of the Taj Mahal or I can take a picture of the Eiffel Tower and figure out what it is. So why can't I do it for this? And, you know, the whole world of, therefore, writing a lot more complexity, and changing the level of maturity in the applications that we are writing is huge. I do believe that with machines being able to do more and more, the need for, in many ways, understanding concepts about artificial intelligence is becoming more and more severe because as a young man or woman, if you go into a workplace today, you will expect a lot more than what any workplace computing systems or IT systems or applications can deliver to you. And the people who are writing these applications, therefore, have to really completely redo the way they think and work. Then on user interfaces, today you find amazing applications which are 1, 1.5 year old can actually start working on. They are voice interface, they are touch interface, they are all of these kinds of things. And, you know, this is something which is, again, you know, the ability to write such simplified applications requires complex thinking and complex work. And I think that's where the future will go more and more. And then, of course, the biggest change, which I find, is miniaturization. How do we start thinking smaller and smaller? For writing an order processing application 10 years ago, 20 years ago, on the IBM mainframe, maybe it used to cost us $10 million. With the new client server tools and all of that, maybe it was $5 or $6 million to put together the same functionality. With some of the more sophisticated tools and as the browser based and new technologies came on and internet, etc., maybe the same application cost $3 or $4 million. And today, you're writing apps which may be costing a few hundreds of thousands of dollars, you know, which provide the same functionality. So how do you start thinking so differently, I think, is another very, very important component in terms of skills. So the concepts of how budgeting will be done, how planning will be done, in addition to the technical skills which I talked about earlier, I think all will start changing.
This question is slightly different in the sense that I'm going to talk about now computing as a profession. So, you know, we have things like medicine and law and accounting, which are considered professions. Do you feel that computing should be a recognized profession on par with those others, with things like demonstrated professional development, adherence to a code of ethics, personal responsibility, public accountability, quality assurance, and recognized credentials?
Certainly, I do believe that this has become a profession. I mean, I do believe computing is a profession because at the end of the day, if you look at it, more than 55%, 60% of Fortune 500 capital investments have something to do with technology. I would hate to turn around and say that all of this is being left in the hands of a non-profession, so to speak. I think with the amount of things which are happening by smart machines, having a very strong code of ethics for all companies and for all people in companies is all very, very important. And given the fact that if you notice more and more, we are seeing more and more evidence of this, hackers are being held personally accountable. Companies which have done this have a lot of public accountability and so on. And I think one of the biggest challenges is that, you know, this is an industry, technology is an industry, I would say, it has brought about significant amount of innovation, significant amount of changes, high amount of productivity, but I think it has also brought about a attitude of relatively poor quality. And when I say an attitude of relatively poor quality, if something doesn't work on your computer, you will restart your computer and you will learn to live with it. You will not do that with your car. I mean, if your steering doesn't work, I mean, you will be screaming blue murder. It will cause lives to go away. It will cause potential damage to people. It could cause harm to people in a very significant way. It could destroy lives and so on and so forth. We need to get computing to the level in terms of quality where people accept that this is now becoming an important enough area to have very stringent quality standards and at a very bare minimum, not have disclaimers where people write which basically say, hey, you know, this software won't even do what it promises to do. You know, this software should do what it promises to do at the very minimal, right? And I think those are the kinds of things that I believe, yes, and therefore I believe that as you formally recognize computing as a profession, some of the biggest improvement I think will happen in quality standards and quality assurance for all the output of this industry, and I think that will be a very, very important thing.
I'm just thinking that this goes back to this whole idea of outcome-focused accountability, and that really the whole market should shift in this way. And then it also reminds me of cellular service, right, where we just accept poor service, and I guess we shouldn't. Now, on this next...
Absolutely.
Sorry about that.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, you know, the fact is that for certain types of conveniences, we are actually willing to accept pretty poor quality. I mean, and the whole notion of quality, in fact, it's an interesting one, you know. When you had the first transistor radio, this little portable device, you know, you would hear, you know, and so-and-so has hit the ball, and the ball's going, and you would get so much of static and so much. But to that little boy who's holding the radio against his ear, there is no other way to get that news, or there was no other way to get that news. And slowly you started making it more digital quality, you started making it high fidelity, and you started doing all of that stuff. So it all underwent transformation. But innovation, when it starts, it almost assumes that the quality won't be as high. And I'm just saying that I think you should put an extra layer of filter of quality on it.
Yeah, and I guess that would... excuse me, improve the industry considerably, and I think we should maybe put a greater focus on quality. Now, for this next question, Finis, you, as I mentioned, you're an amazing individual. You're a world leader, world thinker. You have an incredible history of accomplishment in terms of companies and the success that they've had and continue to have in delivering valued services. From all of this, you've traveled a lot. You've been to all different kinds of places. You've spoken at many conferences. Are there any interesting stories you want to share? Maybe something amusing, surprising, unexpected, or amazing?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there are a few interesting stories. I'll tell you a couple. One which was very work-related. I remember many years ago, and I'm talking 20, 21 years ago, I was working with a multinational company in the U.S., we were bidding for a very prestigious project, which was a very large project. At that time, a couple of $100,000, which was more than 10-15% of our company's revenue at that point of time. And, you know, like all good salespeople, I actually went out with the project manager in tow and said, look, this guy's just come off a project and, you know, he's ready to start the work. You just have to give us the go-ahead. And like all good CIOs, this American gentleman turned around and told me, you know, I'm sorry, we have a little bit of a budget problem. You've quoted so much, and my budget is actually 10% lower than what you've quoted. So either we have to rebid, or if you can agree to do it for 10%, we really like your approach, but if you can do it, that'll be really good. And, you know, I had obviously heard this line many times before, and I was a decision maker, but one never wants to let anybody know that one is a decision maker. So I said, is it okay if we discuss, because we really have to figure out whether we can do it or not, and so on and so forth. He said, sure. I said, do you mind if we speak in Hindi? Because the project manager was somebody who spoke Hindi, and I spoke Hindi. He said, no problem. So he continued to do his email, and we were discussing in Hindi. And actually, I was telling the project manager, it's a good thing he didn't ask for 30 or 40% less, because for such a prestigious project, we would have done it for even that. I'm glad that he asked for only 10% less, and so on and so forth. And after about 5 minutes of intense discussion, which actually was nothing, I went back to the customer and said, 10% looks too difficult to do, but we may be able to do about 4% less or so on and so forth. Anyway, the customer, you know, we negotiated, and after about an hour of negotiation, the customer had his 10% down price, and we had the deal. And just when I was leaving, he turns around and he tells me, Bahut Dhanyawad. And Bahut Dhanyawad in Hindi means thank you very much. And I looked at him. He said, yes, I was in Delhi for 17 years. I speak pretty fluent Hindi. And I was just thinking, my God, I mean, here is, you know, you assume so much about people that, you know, you wouldn't think that any American would have spoken Hindi or whatever it is. And yet, I think, you know, it is a basic thing about never making any assumptions on this. He turned out to be a very sweet man. Obviously, he heard my whole conversation about 30-40%. He must have been smiling. He knew he had got his 10% anyway. But that was really quite amusing and taught me a big, important lesson in life about never assuming anything. Another interesting story, not at all work-related, was... I'm a little bit of a foodie. I'm vegetarian, but I'm a little bit of a foodie. And every country I go to, I actually try and sample some of the local cuisine. And I went to Japan for the first time in 1995, I think it was. And I said I must go to a mom and pop small Japanese restaurant to try some authentic Japanese food. And I walked into this mom and pop restaurant where everybody was eating these steaming, lovely rice noodle soups, dishes, all kinds of things. And, you know, it was quite interesting and tempting. And the big mistake, of course, was that I didn't realize that I didn't speak a word of Japanese. And nobody in Japan, or at least in that time, and hardly anybody spoke any English, and certainly not on the small restaurant. Anyway, the lady came to take my order, and I could not communicate to her that I wanted anything she wanted to give me as long as it was vegetarian. And I said, I couldn't communicate that. And finally, luckily for me, there was one other patron in the restaurant who actually spoke a smattering of English, and just a smattering. So he kind of saw me struggle with this lady, and he came and asked me, what exactly are you talking? So I said, look, I would love her to surprise me. Whatever she wants, she can get me, as long as it's vegetarian. I don't eat fish, I don't eat meat, etc., etc. And he explained to her, and I saw the light go off in her eyes. Ah, now I understand, kind of a light, which went off in her eyes. And about 10 minutes later, I got two slices of toast. And I thought, toast is not exactly Japanese cuisine, but maybe it's an accompaniment to something. And I waited for a few more minutes. And then that lady spoke to that other gentleman again, and that gentleman comes and asks me. He says, the lady wants to know why you're not eating. I said, I'm waiting for my food. And they had an exchanged, an active dialogue, and after that he comes back and says, I'm sorry, that's all you can get in a Japanese restaurant if you want vegetarian food. So my first authentic Japanese meal was actually two slices of toast. Of course, since then I've come to eat very many delightful Japanese vegetarian meals, but this is quite an interesting anecdote, I thought, from my past travels.
Well, that's a great story. It's making me smile. Well, Finish, we're down to our last question, and this is where I turn the tables and I say, if you were conducting this interview, what, you know, one, two, or three questions would you ask, and then what would be your answers?
Well, I think, you know, one of the questions certainly that I think would be useful is to understand, you know, probably what makes, you know, what are the qualities or what traits might make a good leader? And of course, we all have different cuts on that. And to me, the concept of the real concept of the fact that you have to be able to make significant profits in a compassionate manner, the fact that you have to be a really good people leader, and you have to think about your people, and all of those things are all significant attributes. One of the things which people just forget is a large part of leadership. And, you know, the reason I think why more leaders are successful compared to many others is just that they work much, much, much harder than anybody else. And, you know, if I look back on my own life and career, I think, it's very difficult to believe that you can get significant achievement by ordinary work. If you want significant achievement, you need extraordinary work. And extraordinary work is difficult to do in 35, 40 hours a week. And, you know, it's a question of what are the prices you're willing to pay. And, you know, I have worked 70, 80 hours a week probably for the last 15 to 20 years. And just by working a lot more than anybody else, I mean, you know, you achieve a little more than anybody else because of the fact that that's what it is. And that, to me, I think, you know, it's not like I'm a workaholic or anything like that, but it's just understanding what you want to do. If you want to achieve a lot more different results, my argument is that that can only happen by working extraordinarily hard.
You know, your advice on working extraordinarily hard, I guess it kind of ties into Malcolm Gladwell's sort of 10,000 hours to be an expert in his book Outliers. So, you know, sort of backed by research out there of the truly greats, they put in this tremendous effort. And it's clear that you've done that. You were one of history's greats, and all the accomplishments you've made in so many domains. And I want to thank you for coming in. I know your schedule is very busy, and we're very fortunate that you sat down to do this interview and shared your deep experiences with the audience. So thank you very much.
Yes, thank you very much, Stephen. It was a pleasure. Thank you very much.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Finish Murthy, CEO iGate. Finish is a global founding ICT industry top executive and global thought leader.